Good evening, everyone. So glad we're here. We're talking about restlessness. I would say that if aversion is my go-to hindrance, then restlessness is the hindrance I run away from. The poem I read at the end of the sit, it seems so appropriate to me because, in a way, restlessness is that aspect of us that is taken off, it's running, and it can cause a great deal of dysfunction and difficulty in our lives. And there's a way in which I'm hoping by the end of the month, we can build the spirit of bringing it back into ourselves, bringing that running waywardness that restlessness can lead us into, bring it back to ourselves where it's safer and protected. So, but before I kind of go too much into actual restlessness, I want to talk a little bit more about hindrances, coming to understand these hindrances. Because the hindrances themselves, the more you understand them as a practice experience, the less labeling we get caught up in. So if I talk about it as just, restlessness, then it kind of creates this concept in our mind of a thing, a noun, a restlessness, and this is what I'm going to work on. But if you think of the restlessness that we're going to talk about as being the same as desire and aversion that we talked about in January and February, and this sloth and torpor we're going to talk about in April, Tim's going to talk about that in April. It's all kind of the same energetic field, so that you don't get it too caught into naming one other than the other. And one way to think about this is the way they're talked about in the suttas. I don't know, but when I read the sutras, that's where for those of you in the beginning class, the sutras is sort of like the books where the things that Buddha was supposedly said are recorded. The things that happened during Buddha's lives are recorded. And when you read them, Buddha doesn't really talk like we talk. He doesn't really have this way of explaining things down to the minute detail so you understand exactly what's going on. Instead, he just gives these similes, there's more of a just saying the way things are. And you, the practitioner, we end up having to experience and understand that from our own practice, not from somebody explaining it to us. And in some respects, in the West, and when we practice, we do a lot of explaining everything out. So I thought I would just give you some of the examples of how the suttas talk about the hindrances in general. So they have some context around them. So one, it's talked about like an obstacle that overwhelms awareness and weakens discernment. And the example that's giving this kind of thing that overwhelms the awareness and weakens discernment is explained like this. It goes, suppose there were a river flowing down the mountain, going far, its current swift, carrying everything with it. If a person were to open water courses leading from both sides, the current in the middle of the river would be interrupted, diverted, and dispersed. The river would not go far, its current would not be swift, and it would not carry everything with it. In the same way, if a practitioner has not rid themselves of these five hindrances, there is no possibility that they can know what is for their own benefit, the benefit of others, or both, or that they could come to realize superior attainment, this truly noble knowledge and vision. So this awakening capacity, we can't know that. We can't know what's of benefit of ourselves, we can't know what's of benefit for others, and we can't know what is of benefit of both of us when our capacity for awareness has been overwhelmed by these hindrances. So now here's what it's like if the hindrances are dealt with or abandoned. But suppose there were a river flowing down the mountain, going far, its current swift, carrying everything with it. If a person were to close off the water courses leading from both sides, the current in the middle of the river would not be interrupted, diverted, or dispersed. The river would go far, its current swift, carrying everything with it. In the same way, if a practitioner rid themselves of these five hindrances, there is the possibility that they could know what is for their own benefit, the benefit of others, and the benefit of both. And then they would get this attainment or clear seeing. So in this simile, you can see it's as if the hindrances are interrupting our capacity to flow with whatever the moment is, whatever's coming up. This ability to just flow with life, our capacity to be with it, is being interrupted, cut off, diffused, diverted into something other than what is currently there. And we can't just flow into the moment, whatever's happening. The hindrance is the what are called water courses. I don't know. That's like branches off, like a dam off something, and send the water in a different direction. And so that's what the hindrances do. They send our energy in other directions. So since we're primarily talking about the restlessness tonight, what restlessness does is send our energy out into the future, send our thinking mind into the future, send everything about our experience from the present moment off into the future somewhere. And that sending of the energy off into the future is what causes an inability to be aware and discern what is the appropriate thing to do right now. What is of benefit to me, myself, to some other person, or to both of us? What is the most appropriate thing to do? Instead, we're caught off into the future with our energy being interrupted or diverted. Another simile that the Buddha uses to explain the hindrances is this. It says when gold is debased, it's sort of like this impurities is what this is going to point to. This impurity that leads to a kind of inflexibility, brittleness, a rigidness. So the example is when gold is debased by these five impurities, it's not pliant, malleable, or luminous. It's brittle and not ready to be worked. And then which five? He talks about iron, copper, tin, lead, and silver. If that's in gold, it affects it. But when gold is not debased by these five impurities, it is pliant, malleable, and luminous. It is not brittle and is ready to be worked. So in the same way, when the mind is debased by these five impurities, which are the five hindrances of for those of you from the beginning class, the five hindrances are desire. You might remember from the beginning classes, desire, aversion, restlessness, sloth and torpor, and doubt. So when the mind is debased by these five impurities, it's not pliant. It's not malleable or luminous. It's brittle and not rightly concentrated. So these hindrances, they're... You can think of them as the impurity that keeps us from being able to be flexible, that keeps us from being able to bend and move with life, and we get dull and rigid in the way that we see life. Things have to be a certain way. And if we point this directly to restlessness, you can see how we get so caught up in our fear around what we think is going to happen in the future that we start creating all of these blocks and requirements and controls in our lives so that we get some kind of security. But inevitably, that security, what we're using to create security, is by its nature unreliable. We're using the things that we can acquire in life in order to create security for us. But in effect, that attempt at trying to create that security is where the impurity of restlessness comes in. Because the mind gets forced into believing that the right job, the right car, right amount of money, right neighborhood, all these things are going to protect us. But there is this restlessness, unease in the mind trying to always hold them up because they are inevitably going to begin to pass away and shift and change. You can have the right job, but all of a sudden, some new person gets hired. Now I can't get along with that person. Or you can have the right car, but before long, somebody's going to ding that door, especially if you live on Capitol Hill, I assure you. It doesn't really matter what it is that we put our faith and trust in. Eventually, those things are going to let us down. And it's the impurity that ends up affecting us because we lose our luster in life and our capacity depending too much on these things outside of us for security. So another capacity, another way it's explained is these hindrances prevent our ability to see things as they truly are. We can't see in the present moment what's actually going on. We're kind of trapped in our in the hindrance view rather than in this kind of realistic view of what's going on. So the similes that they use for that is, it's rather long, so I'm not going to read them all. I'm just going to read the one for restlessness and just tell you what the other ones are. So this is about imagining that you are looking into a bowl of water, some type of water. And so it says, now imagine a bowl of water ruffled by the wind, disturbed and covered with waves, such that a person with good eyesight examining the reflection of their face in it would not be able to know or see their face as it has come to be. In the same way, when one remains with awareness possessed by restlessness and anxiety, overcome with restlessness and anxiety, and neither knows nor sees the escape as it has come to be from restlessness and anxiety, Once it has arisen, then one neither knows or sees what is of their own benefit, the benefit of others, and the benefit of both. So the example for restlessness is water that is whipped up by wind. The example of water for desire is water that has a lot of shiny jewels in it. The example of water for anger is water that's boiling, like heated so hot that it's boiling. And the example for the water for sloth and torpor is water that has algae and slime over the top of it. And then finally, the water for doubt is water that's muddy. All right, so you can't. So the thing about this way that the simile, the examples is, you assume that you have good eyesight, right? You can see what's going on, but you're blinded by the hindrance so that you see the hindrance and you don't see anything else. You can't see your own reflection. You can't see what's actually going on. All you see is the hindrance. And if you think about this in relation to restlessness, worry, and this anxiety, we get caught in the future thinking and so caught in that so much that we don't even realize none of that stuff is actually happening. We're just caught in this mind-spinning, whirling thing of wind that we're lost in, and the mind gets frantic over, and our bodies begin to respond as if this is actually happening, when in reality, none of that stuff is actually upon you. Especially since most of these hindrances are affected around our sitting practice. You're sitting there meditating. You are not doing nothing. You are just sitting there. Your body's not even doing anything, and yet the mind can be so caught in restlessness that you are living out some terrible thing looming upon you. It's an example of this. I don't know if I've told this before, but one time when I was at work, I was like maybe 5 minutes to five, and I was in my office doing work, and somebody slid this little note under the door. So I picked up the note, and it said that the head of the criminal division, I was a prosecutor, and so it said the head of the criminal division needed to see me. I need to make an appointment. That is the last thing I remember until I hurt myself thinking about being homeless and no one was going to take care of me. And when I heard that, that's when I realized I had spent, it was about 10 o'clock at night, and I had spent from 5 minutes to five to 10 o'clock spinning in this world that I had no idea. I mean, none of it was true, but the mind was off running, and I was gone off with the mind. I'm like running with it. So in some respects, you can't see anymore where you really are, because the hindrance has grabbed you and taken you, and you're off with this hindrance. So the last example I want to give is the example that the hindrances are related to how we get this idea that we get consumed by these hindrances, and we relate our whole life as if all of this is actually happening. Hold on. So, this is another long sutra, so I'm not going to read all of it. I'm just going to read what it is for sloth and for restlessness, and I'll tell you what the other ones are. They're so apropos. This is really how we get impacted by it. Oh, yes, and restlessness, we might have to change it a bit to kind of get it, but I'll read what it is first, and then we'll have to make some little more modern understanding. So now, suppose that a person is a slave, subject to others, not subject to themselves, unable to go where they like. At a later time, they are released from that slavery, subject to themselves, not subject to others, freed, able to go where they like. The thought would occur to them, before I was a slave, now I am released from that slavery, subject to myself, not subject to others, freed and able to go where I like. Because of that, they would gain joy and experience happiness. So in this example of the hindrance, it's pointing primarily in restlessness. Well, let me just tell you the other ones before I explain it. The thing that I wanted to change is because theoretically we don't think slave. We don't think, oh, I'm a slave. We don't have that concept in our minds about what that would be like. So think about when you are working at a job that you wish you could get out of. You hate that job and you do not want to work on that job, but you cannot leave. You feel like you are stuck and trapped in that job and you cannot get out. And let's say your boss is particularly, what do you call it when they're very picky and always in your business and all of that? It's like they're just... That's it. Micromanaging, they're always on you, always bothering you, and you feel compelled by that energy. You're stuck in it, trapped in it, have no way to get away, or have no way to be free of it. That is that sense of slavery. It's to put it in the context of a job that you cannot leave, and this sense that you're trapped by this job. The example they give for desire is that you are deeply indebted, and then the freedom that comes if that debt were lifted from you, if that debt were paid, and then you had access to your money. When you're indebted, you have no access, you don't have money, you're weighted down by it, your whole life is consumed by this debt, and then when that debt is gone, and you have this sense of freedom to do what you want with your money and protect your family and yourself. Or for aversion, it is sickness, a grave illness where it's like you are, you're grumpy, you can't even enjoy food, you can't enjoy any sense of anything, and then you wake up one day and that sickness is lifted, it's passed. And then there's a sense that you can enjoy life again, and you have your health back, your life back. For sloth and torpor, it's as if you are bound in prison. You're in jail, you're held, pretty much have to just, you can't freely go where you want to freely go. And then the release of that would be you're released from prison, and you're let go, and you can travel about, do what you want to do. And then for doubt, it is you have, you know, like your money, your passport, your credit cards, and you're going on a journey through a pretty dangerous area, like a pretty dangerous part of town. And there's a worry about you that you're not going to be safe and you're not going to make it home. And then when you get home, and you still have all your possessions and everything is good, there's a release of that sense of something's gone wrong. That is this idea that the hindrance themselves, when we actually practice with them, we can get a sense of freedom, unlike whether or not I get a new car or I think my job is great or you know, I have some thing in my life that I think is going to make everything okay. There's an internal sense of release and freedom that comes with practicing and understanding the nature of these hindrances. And that is, and that understanding, that awakening also impacts how we live our lives. So in some respects, when we're practicing with these hindrances, it's not just whether or not I can have a good sit, or am I going to have a bad sit, or there's hindrances there. It's more of beginning to see the nature of these hindrances, how that hindrance, whichever one it is clouding my view, preventing me from seeing clearly what's happening here, how it's interrupting or diverting or diffusing my my energy or my capacity to understand the right or the appropriate response for this moment, how its impurity is making it so that I cannot be flexible. I cannot see beyond my own rigidity. And then it's imagining or beginning to taste into the total inner freedom when we release ourselves, when we practice with these hindrances and we release ourselves from the pressure or weight that they carry upon us. So you can see how talking about it from those similes, it's a different experience than if I just talk about restlessness and I stay with restlessness. There's a way in which you may not relate to the, you know, the slavery thing, or you may not relate to the idea of gold and impurities. You may think, oh, that doesn't make any sense to me. But you may understand this idea that a river can flow with life, and somehow or another we get cut off or interrupted or have an inability to flow. Or you might understand that I can't see myself clearly because I'm caught in the, I can only see the wind that's affecting the water that I'm looking at. You see, so these similes in some respects, I think, I don't know for sure, but I would think that Buddha, if somebody were to ask the question, he wouldn't just give an answer. He would just give an example. Well, say this happened or say that happened. So there's a sense that you have to begin to understand for yourself what that looks like. So we'll talk a little bit about restlessness here a little. And I got some Rumi quotes. So, because I think Rumi really works well with worry and restlessness. This is what it starts out with. It says, all your anxiety is because of your desire for harmony. Seek disharmony, then you will gain peace. That's perfect. If we actually were trying to be in disharmony, we'd be fine because we're always in disharmony anyway. So anyway, so restlessness itself, like all the other hindrances, our mind, it is a mental thing. It is not a body thing. It's in the mind that restlessness exists. It is unrest in the mind. But when I first started practicing, because anxiety and worry, which is sort of like the underlying thing that the mind is doing when it's in its unrest, I always felt that as a body thing. You know, like I felt all this anxiety and tension and panic, worry in the body. And that feeling of the body can give the impression that restlessness is something that's going on in my body. But I want to see if I can tease those two apart. So I'm just going to talk about the mental and then talk about the body in just a few minutes. A way to think about restlessness is that we are giving unwise attention to a mind that's unrest. It's not in rest. So a restless mind, we're giving unwise attention to that. Unwise attention to a restless mind. When we give this unwise attention to a restless mind, what it means is that something arises that disturbs the mind. We're going to talk a little bit more about this, but about the body. But it's usually this felt sense of something, like a memory of something. Something I was supposed to do and I didn't do. There's this memory that shows up. Or I see something. Something, stimulus, rises up. Mind gets restless, uneasy about it. If we are not aware, not paying attention, not having wise attention, then the mind will immediately go into this proliferation trying to solve for X. It is just solving, going here, going there, creating all kinds of dramatic things based on its own memories and projections into the future. And it's gone on. It can do it on its own. It doesn't really need us. And we just follow along with it in this kind of exaggerated storyline. I think what makes it even worse, I mean, I don't know what it was like when the Buddha was talking about restlessness in his time to people. I don't know what people were like. I'm assuming that minds are the same, but there has got to be something that happens with television. There's got to be something that is affected. The mind is affected by TV in a different way. I'm probably going to be, I should be saying this, a little embarrassing, but I can remember the moment I realized that my relationships, all my partners, my relationships were like soap operas. They just seemed like there'd be this flow of this kind of something's going wrong and it's all dramatic and and then there's this like some kind of understanding and there's love and it's great, it's wonderful, so good. And then some little stirring would happen and then there'd be this dramatic big thing and back to love. It's just this constant coming and going and coming and going, which is the way television shows go. And in growing up, there was this constant watching television all the time at my house. And especially because my family was so dysfunctional, television became this big deal. And then all of a sudden, I could begin to see when I started practicing more and more and more how much my life was being controlled by television and the way that television moves through. So in some respects, when we're not paying attention, the mind goes off into its own TV show, its own idea of what it thinks is gonna happen or what it thinks is gonna go on. And we have minds that were designed to deal with threats. That's just pure and simple. If you come from trauma, you even have a much greater threat matrix in your mind. And so when the mind goes off on its own, it's not going off to fairyland. It's going off to some kind of dangerous, treacherous, all hell's breaking loose, every man for himself. That's the place it's going. And if we don't pay attention to it, it's gone. But the body that we have begins to then react to this mind that has gone off into some treacherous place. It says, Here's another Rumi thing. Although the road is never ending, take a step and keep walking. Do not look fearfully into the distance. On this path, let the heart be your guide, for the mind is hesitant and full of fear. He said the body, but I changed it to mind, because he's talking about the body mind, that mind that we have and that's intersymbiotic to the body. That thinking mind goes off into these treacherous places, and we're like following along. What the mind is actually trying to do is solve the problem from the stimulus. It's trying to fix or ensure that there is some kind of pleasure, pleasant, good thing coming along. But the mind itself, this thinking part of our mind, cannot calm itself down. It can spin itself up, but it cannot calm itself down, because that sense of calm is an embodied experience. It's a body experience that helps the mind calm down. So we then become at the mercy of this spinning mind until it lets go, grasp onto something else. And basically, we cannot see, because of like those similes, that we have been caught in that mind, in that restless mind, and we are following it. But we can experience the overwhelm of hindrances in the body. We can experience that actual felt sense. And it's because even though the hindrances are deluded thinking in this kind of lost way that we get caught, the body is still present. It's still in the present moment. And so the felt sense of these hindrances are a doorway into beginning to know I'm caught in a hindrance. It's like the doorway or the bell. When we ring the bell, you know that the meditation is ended, because you hear that bell. And you can hear that bell whether you're lost in thought, whether you're pretty much going to sleep, or where you're in some great state of bliss. You can hear that bell, and the bell is what helps us know that the meditation has ended. Likewise, the felt sense of these hindrances is like a bell. So we can keep in mind that the reason why the mind is going off in restlessness is because the mind tries to fix unpleasant, something that stimulates the mind into this unrest or this restlessness is an unpleasant experience. Or it could be the fear that this pleasant experience is going to end, change, something's going to happen. But that sense of displeasure, not liking, uncomfortable, not right, the mind thinks something's bad, is what triggers this kind of unrest into the mind. And when it goes off, it's looking for pleasure. It's looking for some means of either fixing this problem or creating pleasure in a way that I'm going to make things right. And we just go along with it. The practice actually is going in a different direction. It's going in the opposite direction of the mind's natural impulse to go towards pleasure as soon as something unpleasant happens. And that shift, that fundamental shift in going in a different direction, is what we're working on when you're practicing with the hindrances. So we're cultivating, instead of taking refuge in the thinking mind's ability to figure this out, we're taking refuge in the body and knowing that the body has its own inner stillness, its own inner ability to calm itself down and to calm down the mind and to ease that that dis-ease or that restlessness. So what we need is two things. We have to have this sense of mindfulness, and we have to have a sense of the Vedanas, the feeling tones, right? There's a tone to it. There's a quality of displeasure, unpleasantness. And actually, when we put that unpleasantness and we put that mindfulness together, we can become aware that we are suffering. That is what happened in the mind, was hearing myself saying, I'm gonna be homeless, and feeling into the suffering of what was happening. That is what opened up my awareness, what was going on about my job. Nothing happened. I mean, all of that panic was not even, it was really quite something good. But I had no idea. The note was just slid under the door and I was gone. And we can't call ourselves back when we're gone. The thing about these restlessness, I mean, these hindrances, they create such a film over our existence and our thinking. We can't always see it. We're just in it. But there comes a point when we feel that tension, we feel that worry, we notice that we're spinning in something, we hear or see something or experience something that tells us we are caught in this restless mind. And in that moment, that is your sort of opportunity for liberation. It's in that moment that you can turn and go the other direction. Going the other direction means that you are not going to follow the impulse to avoid, push away, and get rid of or find pleasure when something is unpleasant. That you're going to go the opposite direction and be still with this unpleasantness and see what's really going on. Steady yourself. Close off the waterways so that you can flow with whatever's happening, or clear out the impurities. You know, let yourself just be with the experience of what it is. Rumi says, try not to resist the changes that come your way. Instead, live life, let life live through you. And do not worry that your life is turning upside down. How do you know that the side you are used to is better than the one to come? We don't know. The mind thinks it knows, but we don't know. And if we're caught in the mental capacity of the mind's unending story, we'll never know that. Instead, it's learning to practice dropping into the body. So I may have to talk more about this body part next week, but I do want to tell you a little bit about the body part of this restlessness. There is a way in which our bodies experience what we call restlessness, or what I used to call anxiety, and, you know, not the worry, the mental stuff, but I used to call this felt sense of anxiety. It felt like a panic attack, just like overwhelming, like my whole inner body was freaking out. And the sensations can get pretty intense and they can get very difficult. And I experienced this for many years, about 15 years ago. So when I started feeling all this anxiety, for a long time, all I tried to do was come up with something that would get rid of this felt sense of anxiety. It just had to go because it was not any good. But I believe that trying to get rid of the anxiety kept that anxiety with me much longer than it had to be. There's an aspect of our bodies that's just like any other animal body that needs to release energy. It needs to release excess energy that's in the body that doesn't need to be there. So a way to think about it is, we need to do something, whatever the body does, whether it talks, whether it's moving, whether it's sleeping, thinking, it doesn't matter. Everything we do generates some degree of energy, and the body has to generate the energy for us to be able to do it. And some of our thinking can get so complicated and get so big that we do a lot of generating of energy just in the course of thinking. But then we never do anything with that energy. The mind may use up some of it, but we never diminish or diffuse that energy out of us. And we can get our bodies pretty dysregulated, pretty dysfunctional, because we have all this energy in it that needs to go away, but we don't actually do things. We live in a pretty sedentary life. A world nowadays, and we don't really work off a lot of the energy that gets built up in our bodies. So animals, other animals, non-humans, they just shake out excess energy. But we need to be in a safe, still place for the body to actually do its work to let go of energy. And it's mostly letting it go on the inside. On the inside, it's shaking. On the outside, we look still. So for years, I tried to get rid of the very thing that the body was shaking to try to get rid of. Here I am. I come from trauma. I come from difficulty. I got dysfunction all over the place. And I come into practice and I start sitting. And I start feeling safe. And I start feeling still, and then all of a sudden the body starts shaking. So I think I'm panicking. This is not safe. I gotta stop. And I try to get rid of that anxiety. And what I'm theoretically doing is keeping all that energy in the body. And every time I would sit still, it would come back. And I try to keep it down. Just this constant moving, constantly trying to not let that energy be there. So in some respects, we'll talk about it more next, we'll talk about this more next week when we do the discussion. But what we are trying to train ourselves to do is to be still and calm with this excess energy, so that the body can do what it knows how to do, which is eliminate and get rid of excess energy. For all the anxiety I had for years, I still have the felt sense of what I called anxiety. But it doesn't have the sting to it. It doesn't have the panic. It feels like wind traveling through the body. And it goes and it comes just like any other thing. It rises and falls. And I have a completely different relationship with it. It still feels a bit uncomfortable, but it's not the panic heart attack I thought I was having before. And that did not come from me doing anything to make it go away. It came from beginning to neutralize my reactivity to it. I got to a place where I could learn to hold that energy for as long as I could. And the longer I could hold it, the more neutral it became. And the more neutral it became, the less the mind started stopped fighting with it. The less the mind felt that panic and then flew off into its anxiety and rage and worry, and that's the hindrance of this restless mind, worrying, crazy mind thinking. I had to come down into the body and actually experience what would otherwise be an uncomfortable feeling. But that learning to feel that is what actually freed me from a lot of my anxiety, what I would call the panic and anxiety that used to show up every time I meditated. So I'm going to end with this quote from Rumi. I feel like I'm ending it short, but that's because the time is ticking by whether I want that time to tick by or not. So I'm going to end with this quote from Rumi. Kind of ties everything up. He says, I think we should sit quietly for a second. And then we'll drop Rumi into that quiet, which will be a much better way to end. Rumi says, when I run after what I think I want, my days are a furnace of stress and anxiety. If I sit in my own place of patience, what I need flows to me and without pain. From this I understand that what I want also wants me, is looking for me, and is attracting me. There is a great secret here for anyone who can grasp it. That's the bell. Thank you for your kind attention. So I'll see if there is a couple of questions or one or two.
I recognize what you're saying, that's like, you know, my mind's off and running with that fear of loss or fear of losing out or, you know, financially, et cetera, et cetera, security. But it's kind of factual, too. So I just feel like I can
Yeah, I understand.
And do, like, with future plans, do I rent it out, do I put ads out for it, that kind of thing. So that's, I would say that's, and it's running towards something, but also there's other aspects involved too, so I'd like to hear what
else. Well, let's see if I can, if I paraphrase this a little bit here. I think what you're asking me is, how do you relate or practice in a situation where there is some uncertainty and some thing that has to be decided and not sure of what to do, and this constant trying to come up with the right thing to do, and all the difficulty that comes around it, all the felt sense that comes around it in this difficulty? And how do you sort of practice with that, both the practical application that a decision has to be made and the reality that it's not that easy to make some of these decisions? So I'm going to give you my take on what I think what you're saying. You've got the emotional stuff mixed up with the practical stuff. And because that emotional stuff is mixed up with the practical stuff, when the mind tries to figure it out, it cannot figure out emotional stuff. It'll spin all day long, but it will not deal with the emotional aspects that are in the body. And when the mind, if you find yourself like spinning a particular story, what that means in relation to practice is there is a felt sense in the body that's not being listened to. So it's the emotional aspect that's not really being felt, is what it sounds like to me. And instead, you're trying to make a practical decision, but we cannot do that, which is why we spin and spin and spin, because no matter how much we try to say, okay, here's the pros and the cons and let me apply that to the situation, as soon as the emotion in the body happens, we are off again trying to figure it out. We cannot do that. So the practice is really about coming into the body in this embodiment so that you can feel the actual emotional connection to loss or indecisiveness or, you know, it's mostly around probably the loss or the fear that comes with going into the future somewhere else. That, all of that, are emotional things. And that can only be experienced in the body. It cannot be experienced in the mind. And so basically what you're trying to do is when you hear yourself spinning in all these stories is to see if you can let go of the words of it and feel it. It will be uncomfortable. It will be sad. It will be unpleasant, painful, difficult. And everything in your mind, as soon as you start feeling that unpleasantness, you know what it's going to do. It's going to go to the story that's going to make you feel better. But you then leave all that unpleasantness in the body, still to be spinning again. Because while it might go to some pleasant outcome or some pleasant decision, and you think you got it now, because that other stuff, the glue that's still in the body, then your decision will come undone. So it's more about being with the unpleasantness, the felt sense of the body without the story, until that sense, until the body itself tells you that it is released from that. It comes to terms with the loss or the fear or whatever emotion is there. Not the story of it, but just the felt sense of it. And that usually comes, it takes some time to do that, because we have to inch up on this unpleasantness that we don't want to feel. But you just hold it in kindness, be with the body, give it some space, and no matter where the mind wants to go, you just keep going back to the felt sense in the body. So either this is a good sign that you guys don't have no restlessness, or this is a scary sign. It's like, I don't know what to do. It's actually good though, because we do need to do the announcement. So we probably, unless somebody has something, we're just going to like end it here. And we'll talk more next week about how this energy, this normal energy, how do we learn to let that energy be with us and not get afraid of it? It's uncomfortable, but there are ways that we can practice with it that actually help us connect to it. And then in 2 weeks, the next talk, we're going to talk about mostly fear, the emotional aspect of this restlessness, and how to practice with that more so, sort of like in line with the answer to the question, but more how to practice with it, how to frame it, how to hold it a little bit better. So that's how the month will go. And let's see, I think that's it then. I think that's our, I thank you for your patience and your time and your sincere practice. And then I'll let Deb come up and give us our announcement.